Einstein based his theory of special relativity on two principles, the relativity principle and the speed of light principle. So we talked at length about the speed of light principle. The speed of light principle is not simply the statement that light is a universal constant, same for, you know, no matter the motion of the observer or the source. We've split that into two separate principles. Okay, we've called P2 the speed of light principle, where the idea is that for an observer at rest, the speed of light is c, independent of the motion of the source. Okay, and this principle is obvious. Okay, there definitely exists a frame of reference in which, if you're at rest, the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source. Even if you believe in a wave and ether model of light, if you believe in a wave and ether model of light, it's even more obvious. Okay, so this would have been obvious to everyone in 1905 when Einstein wrote his paper. What Einstein did not say was the reverse of this. If you, as we talked about, if you flip the words, if you swap the words observer and source, it reads for a source at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the observer toward or away from the source. Okay, so that's with the flashlight at rest. If I run toward or away from the flashlight, it's not at all obvious that the speed of the light is going to be the same. Right? If I run toward it, the speed I'm going to measure is bigger. If I'm running away, the speed is going to be less. Okay, so the reverse statement is not at all obvious. Okay, but Einstein did not say this. He made a particular point of saying only this, which was obvious. Okay, so that's the principle number two. Now we'll go to principle, we'll talk a little bit about principle number one, which is the relativity principle. And this is the most important. This is the more important of the two principles. It's called the principle, it's called special relativity. It has the word relativity in the title because the principle of relativity is the more important of the two. It's not called the theory of the constancy of the speed of light, right? Besides, that's a messy long name. All right. So I want to talk a little bit about this principle of relativity. Okay, so let's imagine that we are in a train car which is at rest. Okay, and there's a pool table there, and so we're playing the game of billiards. So we're shooting pool balls around. Okay, and we notice certain properties, physical properties of how the game of pool plays out. Okay, so we notice that when we hit a ball against the bank like this, it comes in at some angle and it reflects at the same angle. Okay, unless there's spin. Oh, okay, so if there's spin, then maybe it reflects at a different angle, and so we learn something about the nature of spin. Okay, or if we have one ball over here, another ball over here, and there's a collision between these, then there's some kind of we learn things like conservation of momentum, all that kind of stuff. So we get a sense of how these balls interact with each other. Okay, how the game plays out. Okay, how things behave with regards to the game of billiards. Okay, so now let's suppose that we go to sleep, and in the middle of the night, the train starts off without us knowing, and we wake up in the morning, and the train is moving along a straight, smooth track. Okay, and all the but the windows are closed, so we can't tell that we're actually in motion. And we don't feel any acceleration, so we can't tell that we're in motion. Okay, and so we go and we play the same game of billiards again. Okay, so we shoot the balls around, and we notice that on the second day, okay, same thing. We shoot the ball like this, and whatever angle it hits the bank at, it reflects at the same angle. If we add some spin, then some more interesting stuff happens. If we do collisions, those collisions obey the same laws of conservation of momentum, and so on. Okay, so the game plays out exactly the same way. In the case of we were at rest on the tracks, or we were moving on the tracks with a constant velocity. Okay, as long as we're not accelerating, the game plays out exactly the same way. Okay, so the key point here is that there is no way to determine anything about the velocity of the train by making observations about how the game of billiards plays out. Okay? I can give you a contrasting example. Suppose that you started on one day and you found that, you know, angle of incidence is angle of reflection and so on and so forth. And on the second day you found that, oh, that's no longer true. You know, when the ball hits here at 45 degrees, it comes off at 90 degrees. Then you notice, oh, something's different. Okay? And then precisely how that change, you can analyze that change and so on and relate it to velocity. And then maybe by just playing the game of billiards within your closed, sealed-in train car, you could get some information about the velocity of that train. Okay, but that's not the case. Okay, so we know that there's nothing. So the velocity of the train has no effect whatsoever on the way things happen inside that train. Okay, so that's a very, very important concept. So this was obvious for people. Since Galileo and Newton, they knew that this sort of thing was true. Okay, but what Einstein wanted to do is he wanted to extend that principle to include all physical phenomena, not only mechanical phenomena like a game of billiards, but also electromagnetic phenomena like light. Okay, so let me just write down the principle of relativity, and then we'll continue to talk a little bit more about it. Okay, so this is so this is the relativity principle. Maybe I could actually read. So from Einstein's 1905 paper, the principle of relativity states that the laws by which the states of physical systems undergo change are not affected whether these changes of state be referred to one or the other of two systems of coordinates in uniform translatory motion. Okay, so that's kind of Let's paraphrase that into simpler language here. Okay, so I'm going to write it this way. Okay, so let me just read that out in case you can't read my writing. So, given two inertial observers in uniform relative motion, both are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Okay, so let's go back to our train example here. So here we've got the tracks, and we've got one situation where we are at rest with respect to the tracks, and we've got this pool table in here, and we're shooting game of pool, et cetera. And the laws of nature play out in a certain way. Okay, and we also have a second train car, or us maybe led the next day, where we're moving with some velocity v relative to the tracks. Okay, and we're playing the game of billiards here, and we're shooting the pool balls around and so on and so forth. Okay, so the point of the relativity principle is that given any two inertial observers, by inertial, what we mean here is just non-accelerated. So these guys are not accelerating or rotating. Okay, so we have two non-accelerated observers. So that's true here. This guy's just at rest with respect to the tracks here. This guy's moving with a constant velocity with respect to the tracks. And the tracks are really smooth, and there's no corners or hills or bumps or anything. Okay, so it's a constant velocity on a straight line. That's not accelerated. So given two inertial observers in uniform relative motion, okay, so we've talked about the motion of this car with respect to the track. Well, that's zero. The motion of this car with respect to the track has a speed v. So this guy with respect to this guy, uniform relative motion with a speed v. Okay, so these two guys satisfy the criteria at the beginning of this statement. And then the statement is that both are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Okay, so this guy here, at rest in the same way as this original guy. Okay, so this original guy plays out the game of pool, and the pool plays out a certain way. This guy could also consider himself to be at rest, because the game plays out in exactly the same way. Okay, so this guy can consider himself to be at rest, and it's actually that guy that is in motion that way. Okay, so that's the idea of the relativity principle. Now, let me state that this is obvious for mechanical phenomena. Okay, so everyone knew that since the time of Galileo and Newton. But it's not at all obvious for electromagnetic phenomena. And that was the real problem in 1905. Okay, so why is that not obvious for electromagnetic phenomena? So let me just give you an example here. Okay, so suppose that that we believed in a wave in ether model of light. So we had this this idea of what light is. It's this mechanical phenomena. There exists this this material, this substance, this ether. This sort of elastic substance which fills all of space, and light is just vibrations of that substance in exactly the same way that sound waves are vibrations of air, the substance air. Okay, so for example, if light is a wave in ether, okay, then we could set up the following situation. We could have one train car here, which is, let me draw it a little bit bigger because we've got stuff happening inside. Okay, we've got one train car here, which is at rest with respect to the ether. So the ether I'll just draw as this sort of slashed line here, filling all of space. Whatever it is, it's some mysterious substance. And suppose that this train car is at rest with respect to that ether. And we are going to do a simple experiment, not a mechanical experiment, okay, with billiard balls and so on, but an experiment involving an electromagnetic phenomenon, namely light. So an experiment with light, lasers, whatever, that kind of stuff, clocks, everything. Okay, so here's our flashlight, and our flashlight is stuck to the wall over here. And we're standing over here, and our experiment is very simple. We're going to measure the speed of light. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, we have a ruler like this. Okay, and we click on the flashlight, the beam of light comes at us, we measure the time it takes for the light beam to go from this end of the ruler to that end of the ruler, and then we divide and we determine the speed of light. Okay, so we have the ruler over here, and we have a clock over here, and this light comes out, whatever light is, and, well, in this case we're thinking of it as a wave in ether, light comes out like this, and we measure the time it takes for a wave crest to go from there to there. Okay, and we determine, hey, the speed of light is c. Okay? Now let's suppose that that we consider another train car here. Now this train car is in relative motion through the same ether. Okay? So this is some velocity v relative to this mysterious ether substance. Okay? We're going to conduct exactly the same experiment. Okay? So this guy did this experiment one day. He wakes up the next day, unbeknownst to him, his train car is now in motion with respect to the ether, and he's going to see whether, using an experiment involving light, he can determine the motion of his frame. Okay, so here he is. He's got his ruler again, and he's got his clock. He does the exact same experiment, and what does he measure? How many say C? How many say C plus V? Okay, why are you saying C? Those who say C, why are you saying C? So I'm not asking you what the answer actually is in reality. I'm asking what the answer is if you assumed you were that light is a wave in ether, just like sound wave in air. No, but we're not assuming this guy here. So all we're saying is, let's go back to a pre-relativity concept, and let's just imagine that light is a wave of ether in exactly the same way that sound is this vibration of air. So if light were a wave in ether, and you did this experiment, totally ignoring principles 1 and 2, what would you get here?
C plus. 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 C pl Moving and so
okay, so the light moves with respect to okay, when I'm speaking, yak yak yak, right? My sound waves are going out and they are moving at a speed c, the speed of sound, relative to the still air. Okay? So here's a source of light, and this source of light, whether it's in motion or not, I've got a source of light which happens to be in motion. But whether it's in motion or not, every time that it emits a wave, that wave travels with the speed c with respect to the ether. Okay? So a moving source would look like this. So at one instant of time, a wave is emitted like this. And then at the next instant of time, a wave is emitted, but this wave has now expanded to this size. Okay, the next instant of time, our source has moved to the right and emitted yet another wave. But these other guys have then expanded bigger, and my diagram is getting very messy. But anyways, the point is that these waves, all of those waves, whatever their source location is, as soon as you have a disturbance, that disturbance radiates outward with a speed c in all directions relative to the ether. Okay, so here we have a source that's moving through the ether. The waves that it's emitting, however, are moving with a speed c relative to the ether, in the same way that sound waves move with a speed of sound relative to the still air. Okay, so these waves are moving with a speed c relative to the ether. This guy is in motion with respect to the ether with a speed v that way. Now what do you say? Okay, so these guys are going with a speed c this way, and so you are running at them. So they're going to be coming at you not only at a speed c, but a speed c plus v. Okay? So one day, is that clear? Okay. So one day, you do this experiment with light, and you find the result of your experiment is a number, 3 times 10 to the 8. You wake up the next morning, you do the exact same experiment, and you find the number is now 4 times 10 to the 8. And you say, whoa, something has changed. And so you do various experiments, and so on and so forth, and you determine. And so the result of the experiment depends upon the velocity, which means that you have a handle, you have a way of gripping, you have a way of understanding or determining the velocity. Okay, so the velocity of your train car determines or affects phenomena going on inside, in particular electromagnetic phenomena. Okay, so at the time, lots of people had this wave and ether model of light, and so this idea of relativity was not at all obvious, okay, for lots of them. Okay, so now here comes the main point. What if light is not a wave and ether phenomenon? What if light is instead a physical entity in its own right? Okay, so rather than light being a vibration of some mechanical medium, what if light itself were a physical entity? Okay, like for example, a baseball that moves through the vacuum of space. Okay, I can be out in the vacuum of space and throw a baseball. Okay, that baseball has certain properties. It has momentum, it has energy, all that kind of stuff. Matter has momentum and energy and so on and can move through vacuum. Okay, what if light is the same? What if light has physical properties like momentum and energy and so on and so forth and can move through a vacuum? Let me remind you that in 1905, Einstein also wrote another paper. Actually, he wrote 5 papers that were very significant. One of the other papers was on the photoelectric effect. And in that paper, Einstein was suggesting the idea that light is bundles of energy, okay, moving through space. Okay? And so a little bit like baseballs. Not quite, but a little bit like baseballs moving through space. Okay? So maybe light is not a vibration of some other physical entity, namely the ether. Maybe light is itself a physical entity in its own right, like matter. So this 1905 paper, the real motivation of the 1905 paper, the photoelectric effect paper, the real motivation was to put the theory of electromagnetism, the theory of light, on the same footing as matter. So matter can float through a vacuum with energy, momentum, and all that stuff. And Einstein was suggesting, he was trying to put light on the same footing. So light has properties like energy, momentum, and so forth, and can float through the vacuum. Okay? So that was the motivation of the 1905 paper, of the photoelectric effect paper. And I'm sure that this sort of thing was rolling through his mind with the special relativity paper. Okay, so what if light is not a wave in ether? Okay? Einstein didn't actually say what it is. He didn't actually commit to exactly what it is, but he said that maybe it's not. Okay, so if light is a physical phenomenon in and of itself, just like baseballs and so on, just like matter, okay, so it obeys its own physical laws, like matter, like a baseball, obeys F equals ma. Okay, and electromagnetic phenomena obey another law. What is that? Which equations? Max's equations. Okay, so we've got baseball is some matter obeying F equals ma and so on and so forth on the one hand, and we've got electromagnetic phenomena, light, obeying Maxwell's equations on the other hand. Okay, so we're putting them on the same footing. Okay, they both obey some physical laws of nature. They might be different laws of nature, but they're both physical laws of nature. They're both physical entities with momentum, energy, and all that. And we know that. We know that light has energy and momentum. We certainly know it has energy. When we go outside and put ourselves in the sunlight, we warm up, right? That light is carrying energy from the sun to us. Okay, so maybe it's a physical entity just like any other kind of matter. Okay, so if that's the case, if light is a physical entity just like any other kind of mechanical phenomenon, it is reasonable to try to extend this principle of relativity from mechanical phenomena to include also electromagnetic phenomena. Okay, so that's the main point here. So it's reasonable to extend. To include electromagnetic phenomena. All right. So that was the whole idea. So the principle of relativity is intended to apply to all physical phenomena, mechanical phenomena as well as electromagnetic. Okay, so at the end of the day, we have two believable principles, P1 and P2. Both of these are believable. Okay, so P1 is believable because it seems like a natural thing, as we've just talked about, to try to make that relativity principle. If light has physical properties like just a mechanical system, it's reasonable to try to extend that. Okay, P2 is believable because everyone knows that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source. There exists at least one frame in which that's true. Okay, so that's all Einstein needed. So he bases his whole theory of special relativity on things that in 1905 all physicists would readily accept. Okay? Now something interesting happens. If we put these two principles together, this principle plus this principle, as a logical consequence, it follows that this principle must be true, that P2 prime. Okay, the idea of running toward a flashlight or away, regardless of your motion toward or away from a flashlight, you're going to measure the same speed c. Okay? That's the really unbelievable one. Okay, so this is the one that's completely bizarre, that no one would have accepted at that time. They would have just laughed at Einstein and said, "What are you talking about? That's ridiculous." Okay, so the point is, he starts with these, shows that this is a logical consequence, but then he goes further, and he actually says, he actually provides a way in which we can understand principle number 2 prime, in which we can understand that as being a perfectly reasonable and natural way for things to be. Okay, we can wrap our minds around, and it no longer seems to us as an odd thing. Okay, and in order to do that, Einstein had to change our concepts of what space and time are. Okay, he had to actually understand properly what space and time are. Okay, so that was the point of special relativity, was to make this thing believable. Okay, so that's what we're going to go on. So let's do that. Let's try to make it believable. Okay, so we had determined, we had this K factor here. So let me remind you of that diagram up there. So we'd been playing around with this simple thought experiment where Alice is at rest here and Bob drifts past her. She sends a light signal chasing after Bob. As soon as Bob receives it, he reflects the light signal back to her and so on and so forth. Okay, so we've been playing around with that. Let's now try to determine that value k. So previously we had determined k based upon this universal time assumption, the assumption that when 1 second elapses for Alice, 1 second elapses for Bob, whether he's in motion with respect to Alice or not. When 1 second elapses for Alice, 1 second elapses for everyone in the universe, regardless of their state of motion. Okay, based upon that assumption, we had derived a value for k, if you remember. And that was the non-relativistic Doppler shift. Okay, so you all recall that. So now what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, maybe that assumption is not true. Maybe it's not true that when 1 second elapses for me, 1 second elapses for everyone in the universe. Maybe time is not universal. Maybe we have to give that up. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to find a new way of calculating k, determining k, in which we drop the universal time assumption and replace it with this assumption. I would much rather accept this assumption. I'd much rather this be true than universal time. I don't care about universal time. I would want this to be true. This would make nature simple. Okay? The fact that you are unable in any inertial reference frame, in any reference frame, in any box car or whatever that's not accelerating, there's no experiment whatsoever that I could do that could tell me any information about the motion of that car. Okay? I would much rather that be true than universal time. Okay? So determining k. Okay, so we will revisit that issue. So let me just write down here the important point here. So we are replacing the universal time assumption which is just purely an assumption. We're replacing that universal Newton's universal time assumption with principle number one, the relativity principle. And we're going to see that we can, in fact, determine k. And it's slightly different than the k we got before. But that slight difference is hugely important. Okay? It totally radically changes our concept of what space and time are. Okay, so we had this picture over here, which I'll pull down again. We had this picture before. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a part of this picture and talk about it. Okay, so I'm going to take the part of the picture in which we just have Alice at rest and Bob drifting with some velocity v to the right with respect to Alice. And Alice sends a light signal over to Bob. Okay, so just to sort of abbreviate this diagram so it's not so messy, I'll just write it this way. So here is Alice's world line. We're taking the point of view that she is at rest and that it's actually Bob that's in motion. So if she is at rest, her world line is vertical. Okay? And she sees Bob as the one who is in motion relative to her, moving to the right. So this is Bob moving to the right with some speed v. Okay? And now she does a very simple experiment. Here is the experiment. She just waits a certain time t. And then she sends a light signal chasing after Bob. And we ask how much time has elapsed on Bob's clock. So that's our question mark. Okay? And that time should be proportional to the time Alice waits. The proportionality constant, k, we don't know. That's what we're trying to figure out. Okay? Another way to see this experiment, which doesn't involve Bob at all, is let's suppose that Bob is just a clock. Okay, and so what Alice does is, at t equals, so Alice is just at rest in some frame of reference. Okay, she's not accelerated. Okay, she takes a clock like this, and at t equals zero on this, she has two clocks. At t equals zero on this clock, she throws this clock, okay, with a velocity v. That clock is drifting. Imagine we're out in the middle of empty space. Okay, that clock just drifts through space like this with a velocity v away from her. Okay, after a time T has elapsed on this clock, she clicks on her laser pointer and sends out a beam of light after that clock, and that clock, that laser light eventually catches up with that clock, bang, hits the clock. The clock is designed to stop the instant it receives the light signal. Okay? And so then, after this clock has stopped, Alice runs like crazy to catch up with that clock, which is floating through space. She grabs onto it like this, and she reads the time elapsed on that clock. Okay? So that's her experiment. The time that she sees that's sort of frozen onto that clock now, that stopped clock, is kT. And we're trying to find the ratio of that time to the time on her clock, the time that she waited before throwing the clock. Okay, so that's a very simple experiment involving light, clocks, and that's it. Okay, so this is a simple experiment done from the point of view that Alice is at rest. So Alice is the one who is at rest and Bob is in motion, and she does an experiment. All right. Okay. So now, what we're going to do is we're going to have Bob do the same experiment. Okay. And we're going to take the point of view that Bob is at rest. So in this picture here, we say Alice is at rest and it's Bob that's moving this way. We could also take the point of view that it's Bob who's at rest and Alice who is moving that way. Okay. So let's take that point of view. Okay. So. So now this is Bob at rest. Okay, his world line is vertical. And he is going to conduct exactly the same experiment. Okay, what he is going to do is he's going to stand here. He's got his watch like this. He's got a second clock. And he throws that clock. And then he waits a certain amount of time, T, on his clock. He throws that clock this way. That clock we will call Alice. He throws that clock this way, to the left. He waits a certain amount of time, T, on his clock. He then clicks on his laser pointer. He sends a beam of light chasing after that clock. It eventually reaches that clock, shuts the clock down, freezes the clock, and then Bob runs after that clock, catches up with it, and reads the time on it. And the time should be let's ask what that time is, first of all. So what is that time? Why? Because what? Oh, because I wrote it down. Oh, come on. Hey. It's what? That's right. So, according to principle number one here, the relativity principle, given two inertial observers in uniform motion, and these are certainly two inertial observers in uniform motion, A and B, the uniform motion, the velocity is V. Okay, both are equally entitled to consider themselves to be at rest. Okay, so if we take Alice's point of view, she's at rest, she does an experiment, and she gets the results. The results of that experiment are something. The results are, if it's T here, it's KT there. Okay, and now we've also got Bob. So Bob is equally entitled to consider himself to be at rest. Okay, and he conducts exactly the same experiment. And so according to principle number one, relativity, he should get exactly the same result. Okay, if he waits an amount of time t here, it should be kt here. And it's the same factor of k. Okay, so let me just label this diagram here. So this is from the point of view that Bob is at rest. And Bob does the same experiment. Exactly the same experiment. Okay, so that this is perfectly reasonable. Okay, this is perfectly believable. This is the kind of thing you would like to be true of nature. Okay, so now what? So what can we do with that? Well, I should say that those two diagrams right there are the part of special relativity. If you understand that, everything else follows from that. So this is the logic of special relativity right here in those two pictures there. The relativity principle, this is the key conceptual step here. Is it clear? Okay. Right. So now what we're going to do is something trivial. Now what we're going to do is we're just going to take that picture there and we're going to manipulate it a little bit, put it into a form that's going to be useful when we compare with that picture. Okay? So the first thing we're going to do is we are going to look at, so here's Bob doing an experiment. From Bob's point of view, his world line is vertical. We're going to take the exact same experiment that Bob is doing. Now, instead of looking at it from Bob's point of view, we're going to look at what it looks like from Alice's point of view. Okay? So let's see. We're taking the point of view of Alice. It's Alice that is at rest. So Alice's world line is vertical. Okay, that means Bob is moving to the right with some speed v. Now let's put Bob's experimental observations into this picture over here, the picture that we're drawn from Alice's point of view. So what happens? Well, let's see. First of all, Bob waits a certain amount of time t on his clock. Okay, so Bob's clock starts at 0 here. He waits a certain amount of time t here on his clock. Okay? And then he sends a light signal over to the other person. Okay? And then that light signal is received when Alice's clock reads kt. So I want to emphasize that I haven't done anything here. Okay? All I've done is I've taken the data as seen by, so Bob has some experimental data. And I've just taken that data and put it from the point of view of Alice. Okay? Is this clear? There's no physics involved here. Nothing has happened. I'm not doing any underhand tricks or anything. Okay, so we got that. And secondly, or the final step is to notice that this time here is completely arbitrary. The point about this is if this time is, whatever time this time will be k times that time. If this is 1 second, then this is k times 1 second. If this is 5 seconds, this is k times 5 seconds. Okay? So what we're going to do is, in order to make contact between this picture and that picture, what we're going to do is we're going to replace t with k times t. Okay, so exactly the same picture here, A, B. We're just going to say, so t is arbitrary. So replace t with kt. Okay, so then t over here becomes kt. What is this then? K squared t. Okay? And let me just label this. I didn't label this. So this is Bob's experiment. It's that picture over there. It's Bob's experiment from the point of view that Alice is at rest. So I'll just abbreviate point of view that Alice is at rest. Okay? So there we go. Now this picture is extremely helpful. Because if we look back at our original diagram here, it will tell us something. Okay, so our original diagram, this diagram to, let me draw that diagram again. Okay. So in here, we've temporarily dropped the factors of C. We were plotting really T versus X, but really we want CT. Right? Okay. So at the end of the day, what we have is KCT here. If this is KCT here, then this will be K squared CT. So this picture over here is this part of the picture. That guy there. That's that triangle there. Okay. So here we have KCT. KCT here, then this side is K squared CT. So that means the distance from there to there is K squared CT. Okay? So is that clear? So that's the heart of everything here. Okay, so now the rest is just some simple algebra. So, so what this tells us is, let's see, it tells us that this time plus this time plus this time is equal to that time. It tells us that CT plus D is K squared. C, T. Okay, so let's divide by C. So that tells us that T plus twice D over C is equal to K squared T. Okay, so let me just remind you here. Okay, what are we doing? So previously, we had determined the value of K for sound in air for the non-relativistic Doppler shift based upon the assumption of universal time. And what we got was this. Okay, so you'll remember from last day, if you look back in your notes, that when we made the assumption that time is a universal phenomenon, we got an equation for k which looks like this. T plus d over c equals kt. And we called that equation number 2. And then we combined equation number 2 with the previous equation to solve for k. And we got the non-relativistic Doppler shift. Okay. Now what we're doing is we're dropping the universal time assumption, and we're replacing it with something much more powerful, much more something that we would really like to be true, which is the relativity principle. Okay. And then we played some games over here, and at the end of the day, we got this equation, which we will call 2 prime. So it's a different equation involving k. Okay, instead of t plus d over c, we have t plus 2 d over c. And instead of kt on the right, we have k squared t. So it's a slightly different equation. So now what we're going to do is we're going to combine this equation with equation number 1, which is an equation for d, to then solve for k. Okay? So I will leave that as an exercise for you to do. That's simple algebra. And you get a remarkable result. So just look back in your notes for formula number 1. Combine that with our new equation 2, which I'm calling 2 prime, and that gives us a new formula for k. So it turns out that k is a square root of 1 plus v over c divided by 1 minus v over c. Okay? So this is the relativistic Doppler shift. Okay, so last time we had talked about when we got that value of k based upon the universal time assumption, we had talked about doing this sort of an experiment where you know, one wave crest leaves at this time, a second wave crest leaves at this time. If the elapsed time for Alice between the wave crests is TA, then the elapsed time for Bob will be KTA. Okay, and so then the frequencies are just the reciprocals of this, so that k is associated with directly with the Doppler shift. You can do exactly the same thing, but now with light and the relativistic Doppler shift. And you will notice some very interesting properties about this because of the square root. And because it's possible that this could be negative, okay? Well, it can't be negative under the square root, and there's an important implication of that. Okay, so in fact, there are some problems, exercises designed to let you think through that. Okay, so they're pretty straightforward, but they're really important that you look at. They're just conceptually, if you want to sort of pursue this a bit further, this relativistic Doppler shift. Okay, so not only does it tell us about the relativistic Doppler shift, much more importantly, this k will tell us about the true nature of time. Okay, that's the important thing here. And that's what I want to focus attention on here. All right. So is that all clear? Are we okay? We can. Okay. All right. So let me erase some boards here. Okay, so we want to look at the consequences of this value of k for the nature of time. Okay, so time dilation. Where does that come from? Okay, so let's give us some data here. So let's suppose that Bob is moving at a velocity 80% the speed of light. So v is 4/5 the speed of light. Okay, and let's suppose that, okay, we're going to be doing this kind of an experiment here. Okay, so we've given basically the slope of this line over here. The next thing is we're going to give the time that Alice waits before she sends that light signal chasing after Bob. Let's suppose that she waits 10 to the minus 8 seconds. Okay, so 10 nanoseconds. Okay, so Bob is moving at almost the speed of light. Okay, but Alice is waiting only a super tiny fraction of a second after he passes her to send that light signal chasing after him. So because this time is so small, Bob ain't going to get very far before that light signal catches up with him. Okay, so let's figure out all that stuff. So first of all, if t is 10 to the minus 8 seconds, then ct is what? What is 3 times 10 to the 8 times 10 to the 8 minus 8? 3 meters. Okay. 3 meters. And let's also recall we had a formula that was, that this is actually equation number 1. Recall that d divided by ct is equal to, what is it equal to? V over c divided by 1 minus v over c. Okay, so that was a simple formula we derived that has nothing to do with relativity or anything. It just has to do with the geometry of this setup. Okay? So there's a relationship between d and velocity. Okay, so we and t. So we know both v and t, so we can solve for d. Okay, so we get, what do we get? We get d is equal to v over c, which is 4/5, divided by 1 minus v over c, 1 minus 4/5, times, bringing the ct over to the right, times ct. Ct is 3 meters. Okay, so this is 4/5 divided by 1/5 is 4, times 3 is 12, 12 meters. So this tells us that if Bob is going at 4/5 the speed of light, whipping past Alice, and she waits 10 nanoseconds after he passes to send the light signal chasing after him, then she will catch up with, that light signal will catch up with Bob when he is now, when he is 12 meters away from Alice. Okay, so now we can draw, oh, actually let's work out one more number. So what is k? So k is the square root of 1 plus v over c divided by 1 minus v over c. So what is that? That's the square root of 1 plus 4/5 is 9/5 divided by 1 minus 4/5 is 1/5 is equal to 3. The square root of 9 is 3. Okay, so k is 3. Right. Okay, so just by the way, this is the redshift. This would be the redshift factor. So if Alice's frequency of light were 300 in some units or whatever, then Bob is moving away from Alice. The light signal, according to Alice, has a frequency of 300. For Bob, it would be 1/3 of that. It would be 100. So it would be shifted to the red. Lower frequency, longer wavelength. Okay, so he would see a red shift by a factor of 3 at that velocity of 4/5 the speed of light. Okay, so now let's look at what the consequences are for time dilation. Okay, so here's the experiment. Alice is just drifting. We're taking a point of view that Alice is at rest here. This is her CT axis. Okay, and Bob is drifting past her with some velocity, which we've given, 4/5 the speed of light. And she sends this light signal chasing after Bob, et cetera. Okay. And so let's see here. What do we got? We got this guy, this distance, the time she waits, well, ct is 3 meters. She waits 10 to the minus 8 seconds. 3 times 10, c times that is 3 meters. the distance here we've worked out is 12 meters. Bob gets to a distance of 12 meters from Alice by the time he receives the light signal from Alice. And so because this is 45 degrees here, this is a 45-degree triangle here, this is also 12 meters. Distance from there to there is the same as from there to there. Okay, because this is 45. Okay, so that's that. So what we know here, first of all, how much time has elapsed for Alice between the time that she sent her light signal and the time that Bob received it? Okay. What is it?
40 to the negative 8.
40 to the negative 8? How do you get that?
Seconds.
How do you get that?
CT equals 12 meters, right?
So CT is 3 meters. So this is 3 meters.
Right.
And that's 12.
Yeah.
So I'm asking, what is the time between the moment Bob crosses her path? I'm sorry, did I say that wrong? What's the time between the moment that Bob crosses her path and the time that Bob receives the light signal, according to Alice?
Oh, 15 to negative 8.
So it's 15, right? 15 meters. It's 12 plus 3 is 15 meters. Okay, so let's work that out. So 3 meters plus 12 meters is 15 meters. Okay, that's C times the change in time. Okay, so that tells us that the change in time, every time you put a delta in front of something, it means change in that quantity. So the change in time, or the elapsed time for Alice, between the time that Bob crosses her path and Bob finally receives the light signal, that the corresponding time there, we just divide by C. So delta T is 15 meters divided by C. C is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. If you divide meters by meters per second, the units are seconds. 15 divided by 3 times 10 to the 8 is what? 5 times 10 to the minus 8. Okay? So that's the elapsed time for Alice. Okay, so now let's look at this guy. This guy here is supposed to equal k times CT. Okay, so the elapsed time for Bob in units of meters is going to be just K times that CT. So K times CT is then equal to 3, that was our K, our Doppler shift. CT we worked out as 3 meters. So we have 9 meters. Okay, so the time elapsed for Bob, so the change in Bob's clock reading, the delta in front, that change is 9 meters divided by C. What is that? 3 times 10 to the minus 8 seconds. Okay, so they're all times 10 to the minus 8 seconds. One is 5 and one is 3. Okay, so let me show what this is explicitly here. So here's Alice and here's Bob. Okay, and what we're saying is the two times we're interested, the two events that we're interested in are Bob receiving the light signal from Alice, and the reading on his clock then, and also the reading on Alice's clock at the same time. Okay, so what we've discovered is that from the time that Bob crosses her path to the time that Bob receives that light signal from her, the amount of time elapsed on Alice's clock is 5. We'll just drop the times 10 to the minus 8. It's 5, 5 units of time. So her clock would read 0, and it would go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, but on Bob's clock is ticking as well, right? As Bob, this is Bob. This is actually Bob in motion, right? As time goes on, Bob is moving to the right. This is Bob. This is Bob at one instant of time. This is Bob at another instant of time. This is Bob at another instant of time, and so on. His clock is ticking. One tick of the clock is this guy. The next tick of the clock is this guy, and so on. Okay, so how many ticks of the clock have happened for Bob? Three. Okay, so if Bob had zeroed his clock when he as he flew past Alice, then by the time he receives that light signal, only three ticks of his clock will have elapsed. So his clock would read 0, 1, 2, 3. His clock would read 3 by the time he receives the light signal. Okay? So the really important thing is, when 5 seconds has elapsed for Alice, let's just say this is 5 seconds, drop the 10 to the minus 8, just to make the language simpler. When 5 seconds elapses for Alice, only 3 seconds elapses for Bob. Okay, there's a time dilation here. Okay, so, or in other words, just more generally, in any situation where we have, say, someone here, we'll take the point of view that Alice is at rest, and we have some Bob who's drifting with a velocity of 4/5 the speed of light, say to the right, then when 1 second elapses for Alice, how many seconds elapses for Bob?
5 or 3.
Will it be more or less than 1 second?
Less.
More.
So what is the fraction?
3/5.
Okay, so there's time dilation here. Okay, so here's the main point then. So the point is that for light to be a physical entity, okay, a real physical entity has been physical properties like momentum, energy, and so forth, just like matter does, and can move through a vacuum just like matter does. For light to have that real physical, those real physical properties, and for those physical properties to satisfy the relativity principle, okay, for it to be true that you can't use those physical properties to determine the motion of your train car, okay, in other words, that those physical properties need to satisfy the relativity principle. If all of that is true, then it requires that time not be universal. Okay, so let me just sort of summarize that. So for light, so light to be physical entity, so a physical entity in its own right, traveling through a vacuum, okay, satisfying relativity, okay, requires that time be not universal. All right. Okay, so let's look at this in a little bit more generality. What's our time like here? Okay, so we have about 15 minutes. All right. Is that all clear? Are we okay? Really? If you have questions, just ask away. I really want you to understand this, because this is important stuff. Or ask me later in the to-do-it. Don't be shy. Because we're going to use this stuff now to see some really, really bizarre things. Really, really beautiful. The nature of space and time are incredibly beautiful. When you actually see it, it's just amazing. Okay, so let's hurry up so we can get this. Okay, so what we've done is we've done a particular example. We've plugged in, we've looked at the situation, we've looked at the experiment we've been dealing with, we've plugged in some particular numbers, and we saw some particular amount of time dilation. When 1 second elapses for Alice, 3/5 of a second for Bob. Let's find a general formula, okay, that works for any numbers. Okay, so here's the situation. Okay, yeah, so let's do it this way. Right. Okay, so there's time for Alice, actually C times time. Here's time for Bob. Alice's clock ticking away, tick, 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 tick. Bob's clock ticking away as he drifts away from Alice, tick, tick, tick. Okay? And the experiment is like this. Okay, wait for a time CT, send the light signal over, distance D here. Because this is 45 degrees, if that's D, that's D. Okay, that's why we chose to scale it by CT instead of, or to plot CT versus X instead of T versus X. X. And this guy, if that's CT, that is K times CT, or Doppler shift K times CT. Okay, so what we're going to do is, this is our standard picture. We're going to relabel the sides of this triangle here. Okay, so I'm going to redraw the picture here. We're going to call, so this is the CTA, this is the CTB. And we're going to call this time here, the side of this triangle here, we're going to call it the time elapsed for Alice. That's the change in time for Alice. So it's the change, anytime you write a delta means change. It's the change in Alice's clock reading. But we're multiplying everything by C on the time axis. Okay, so we'll call this side of the triangle C times delta TA. And similarly, this is the time elapsed for Bob. Here's Bob's clock ticking away. Tick, 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 tick. How many units of time have elapsed for Bob? Well, it's K times CT. And we will call that the time elapsed for Bob delta TB. But we're multiplying times by C, so it becomes C times delta TB. And this distance here, this is the distance that Bob reaches from Alice by the time he receives the signal. So that's a displacement in Alice's space. So we'll call that change in X position, XA, delta XA. Okay, so we've just gone from this notation to this notation, just so that it simplifies things. Okay, because we're going to observe some very important geometrical relationships between these three sides of the triangle. Okay, and that's going to be super important. Space-time has a geometry, and we're going to understand what that is shortly. It's really amazing. Okay, so here we go. So first off, let's just identify what these quantities are. C delta TA, the side of this triangle, is CT plus D. Okay? So, or in other words, delta TA is what? Okay. This is what? Okay, and finally we'll write delta XA is D. Okay, so that's that. Now what do we know? Okay, so we recall this equation number one. Remember, this equation number one has no physics in it. It's just based on the triangles and the setup of the problem. Okay, so recall equation number one. I'll just put it up here. D divided by CT, just based on the geometry of the situation, is V over C divided by 1 minus V over C. Just a handy formula that relates distance, time, and velocity, because of the way the problem is set up. So what does that tell us? Okay. So what we can do is we can take, this is a formula for D, and we can stick it into this formula for delta TA. So let's do that. So that tells us that delta TA is equal to T plus D divided by C. What is D divided by C? Well, I need to multiply both sides by capital T. So it's this thing times capital T. Okay, so what is that? Simplify that. Right. So this is 1 over 1 minus V over C times T. Okay. So Now we want what we're really interested in is the ratio of the number of ticks of time on this, on Bob's clock, to the number of ticks of time on Alice's clock, the time dilation, the ratio of this to this. So let's work that out. And then we'll get a general formula for time dilation, which lots of you will recognize. But the way that we have derived it is much more fundamental than the way that you've probably seen before. The way that we've derived it is a way that you can actually believe that the result is true, or must be true. For light to be a physical entity in its own right, just like matter, to put light on the same footing as matter, and that light satisfy relativity, requires all this stuff. Okay, so the ratio of these two guys, delta TB divided by delta TA, well, let's write delta TB. Okay, so that's delta TB. We want to divide that guy by delta TA. Okay, sorry. I'm writing down the wrong thing. Delta TB is K times T. What is K? So that's K. We want to multiply that by T. And then what we want to do is divide by delta TA. Well, we just figured out an expression for delta TA. That's that guy. So we divide by that. So dividing by T over 1 minus V over C is the same as multiplying by this. So what is that? So the T's disappear. So the answer is independent of how long Alice waits. We're going to get the same. Time dilation is independent of how long Alice waits, which must be true. What else? Right. So this is 1 minus V over C. This is the square root of that. So we're left with the square root of this guy in the numerator. So all under the square root, we have 1 plus V over C times 1 minus V over C. Okay. Okay, so there we go. So I encourage you to do that algebra on your own if you're not following immediately. I don't expect you to follow immediately. Okay, so here's the situation. The summary of the whole thing here is that here's Alice's clock. We're taking the point of view that Alice is at rest. Her world line is vertical. Here's her clock ticking away, tick, 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 like this. And here's Bob. Bob is drifting with some velocity v relative to Alice. And so relative to Alice, his clock will be slowed. So the tick marks between his clock ticking will be longer. I'm kind of exaggerating it here. Okay, and the general picture then is this. When an amount of time, delta TA, elapses on Alice's clock, then a different amount of time, delta TB, will elapse on Bob's clock. We know the ratio of those two is that square root. Delta TB is just the square root of 1 minus V squared over C squared delta TA. Okay? How many of you have seen that formula before? Okay, so about half of you. Okay. So, and this is obviously less than delta TA. All right? So less time elapses for Bob than Alice. Okay, so this is time dilation, derived properly. Okay, derived with a proper understanding of what Einstein's speed of light principle was. Okay, so let's actually just do a quick numerical example here. Let's do the same numerical example we did up there, but work out this time dilation factor directly. Okay, so the square, if V is 4/5 C, what is this factor? What is this square root factor? 3 over 5? That's right. Okay, and so what it's saying is, if 1 second elapses for Alice, and Bob is moving at 4/5 the speed of light, then 3/5 of a second will elapse for Bob. Okay? Time dilation. All right. So now I want to talk, what do I want to talk about? Okay, let me do something just very, very quickly. Do you have any questions? Are we okay? Okay, I want to, because just so that we don't leave all this stuff and have to come back to it again, let me just say one more thing here. I want to talk a little bit about the geometry of space-time. Okay, so we know the geometry of space, right? What's the geometry, what's the name of the geometry of space? Or should we just take a break? Are you guys tired? How many vote for a break? How many votes not to take a break? You guys are taking breaks all the time? Who said that? Are you sure? I mean, we can stop.
I got a question.
Michael, what do you think? Stefan?
Answer those questions.
We have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, so, on your triangle up there, you got your 15 on one side and your 12 on the top, right?
Yeah.
So shouldn't the other side be not 9 because it doesn't work in the Pythagorean?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. So the question is this. If you look at that triangle, what we're saying is on one side of the triangle we have 15, on this top of the triangle we have 12, and on this side of the triangle we have 9. Does that look odd to you? Okay. That's exactly what I want to talk about here. Let me just give me 5 minutes and let me just tell you a little bit about this. It's telling you that there is a geometry. Space-time has a geometry, but it's not the kind of geometry you're familiar with, Euclidean geometry. It goes by a different name. It's called Minkowskian geometry. But it is a geometry nonetheless. And that's hugely important to understand. Because space-time geometry starts out, Minkowskian geometry, this geometry here is called flat. Okay? And then in order to go to general relativity, all you do is you warp that geometry. You take that flat geometry and you just bend it up and curve it. And that gives you gravity. So understanding the geometry of triangles like this is crucial. Okay, to understanding that's the step to general relativity, bending that geometry. Okay, so excellent question. Let me just sketch this whole thing again. So what we have on this side in general, this is C times delta TA. This is delta XA. This is C times delta TB. Okay? So now let's just work generally. C times delta TB, this is equal to, okay, I'm going to run out of room. So this is equal to square root of 1 minus V squared over C squared times delta TA. Okay, so let's start with that. Let us square, this is just time dilation. I just wrote that down over there. Okay, now we're going to square both sides of this equation. Okay, so on the left-hand side, we're going to get C squared times delta TB squared. On the right-hand side, we're going to get 1 minus V squared over C squared times, there needs to be a C here, times C squared delta TA squared. Okay? Now let's write what this V over C is. V squared over C squared. So we'll go one step further here. Okay, so we know that V Bob's velocity is the distance over time, according to Alice. So Bob covers a distance delta XA in what time amount of time?
Delta TA.
Okay, so what we've got is this situation. Bob covers a certain distance in a certain amount of time. It's this divided by this. That's the velocity. Okay, so let's plug this expression for V into there. And so we get C squared delta TB times for Bob squared is equal to 1 minus, take V over C, divide this by C and square it. We get delta XA squared over C squared delta TA squared. Okay, so all I've done is I've taken that equation and replaced V squared over C squared with this. Now multiply that by C squared delta TA squared. Okay? The right-hand side simplifies to what?
Delta TA squared.
C squared times delta TA squared.
Minus delta XA squared.
Minus delta XA squared. That cancels that. Okay? This is an extremely important relationship. Okay, so what it is telling you is something really bizarre. So this, let's go over here. It will be done in just a minute or so. Okay, in other words, let's label the sides of a triangle A, B, and C. Okay. What it is saying here is that if we look at this thing here, what is C delta TB? What side of the triangle does C delta TB correspond to?
C.
This is saying that C squared is equal to, what is C delta TA?
A.
What is delta XA?
B.
So it's saying that C squared is A squared minus B squared. Okay, so the geometry that we are all familiar with, the geometry of space, two-dimensional space, say X and Y, if I have any figure, like a triangle or whatever, in say XY space, Euclidean geometry tells me that C squared is A squared plus B squared. Okay, so this is Euclidean geometry. That's the geometry we all know and love. But what this is saying is if I have a triangle and it's not in space, two space, space X, space Y, but it's in space time. So this is an X and this is a T. Actually a C times T. Okay. Then it tells us that the side of this triangle squared is this squared minus that squared. Okay. And this is really important. Ultimately, okay, so let me call this. This is Minkowskian geometry. Minkowski was one of Einstein's professors. And what Minkowski did was take Einstein's intuitive ideas and this whole idea of time dilation, all that kind of stuff. He did calculations like this, and he recognized that, yes, there is a geometry here. So it was actually Minkowski who recognized there's a geometry behind all of what Einstein was doing. Okay, and then at first, Einstein thought this was of no consequence. He just thought, well, that's just mathematical mumbo-jumbo. But then later on realized it's true, it's really, really significant, and it's a launching point for general relativity, because general relativity is about the geometry of space-time. Okay, so at the end of the day, let's just give a simple example here, and you'll be doing some examples if you get around to them in the exercises. So for example, if this is 5 and this is 3, what is this side length? Quick. Well, that was quick. Well, I guess you knew that from that one. Okay, sorry. All right. Okay, so take a break. We'll see you in like 15.